Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. Today, you're going to hear my conversation with Dr. Carlos Cuevas, and he is a lovely person to talk to just generally, but I'm particularly excited because there's a few folks on this series that work between or have had careers that span clinical work and then academic research work. And for so many of us, that is true. But I think there's some folks, and Dr. Cuevas is one of them, that has spent a majority of time, or at least a lot of time, in that clinical space. And so he is, by background, a clinical psychologist and has worked now for a while as a professor and researcher and in the academic world. And so has a lot of interesting points and reflections about what those connections are between the clinical side of things and then his research work today. So enjoy, stay tuned, grab your coffee, and I will see you for the next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers.
So one of the ways that I like to start is just to have you give us a sense of who you are and a bit about your work in the field of violence prevention.
So my name's Carlos Cuevas. I'm a professor at Northeastern University in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. I am a clinical psychologist, though, by training. And so I came from sort of the trauma, PTSD world, if you will. And most of my research has usually been generally in the area of sort of interpersonal violence and victimization and family violence, with a particular focus on sort of understudied, underserviced groups. So a lot of the funded research I've had has been with looking at victimization and violence among Latinos, looking at, you know, sort of sexual violence, adolescent dating violence. Most recently, we've looked at hate crime and bias victimization, the project we just wrapped up. And then we've also sort of have some work that we're going to be starting looking at trafficking victims and healthcare utilization and health, actually physical and mental health. And then we're also have some work that we've been doing looking at the development of sort of a new measure to evaluate dating violence victimization, adolescent dating violence victimization. And so that's probably sort of has summed up my, you know, sort of work the past few years. And because I'm a clinical psychologist, I actually still sort of have a private practice, sort of, you know, sort of still keep my foot in that as well. And that's mostly working with trauma survivors and victims of violence. So yeah, that probably sums it up.
Yeah. So just as a, mostly as honestly a curiosity, but for you as a clinical psychologist, what kind of was that transition for you from doing clinical work to then finding yourself collecting data and on the research side of things?
So I sort of switched that. I sort of started going down the research road pretty early. Actually, so when I went to graduate school, my plan was to be a full-time clinician. And I got to grad school and my mentor there sort of was doing a lot of the sort of violence and trauma research. And I sort of simultaneously sort of not only liked it, but then sort of took to the research and sort of found out I was actually decent at it. And then sort of, became this gradual turn where that got me more into doing research, which when I finished got me into a research postdoc, which, you know, sort of led me to where I am now. So my turn to research was probably pretty early in my grad school career, but it wasn't the plan I had going in. My plan was, hey, I'm going to be a full-time clinician and that's what I'm going to do. And that didn't last very long before I realized, hey, there's something to do this features thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when you, knowing that you maintain a private practice too, sort of where do you see that connection between the research that you're doing and then also how you're interacting sort of on an individual basis?
Sure. So, I mean, I think a lot of it is that one of my sort of critiques of some clinicians is that they sort of do what they were trained to do and don't sort of stay up with research or sort of incorporate that into their practice. And sort of a lot of in psychology and sort of had this clinician researcher split a lot. And so for me, it's more about integrating what I know from the research into what I do in my practice, and sort of being able to sort of balance the ability to integrate sort of things that we empirically know work into my clinical work, because I sort of do so much research. So I know it's sort of kind of then sort of very complementary in a lot of ways. So that's, I think, the nice thing about it. And also, I think for me, the fact that that clinical work is sort of a small percentage of my time is sort of a nice balance in terms of, you know, I have the teaching that I do at the university. Research is probably the bulk of my time, and the having the clinical work, it's a nice because I'm sort of not you know, sort of just doing one thing all at once. And then the other piece of it is sort of by default or by the sort of the subject area. I also end up doing a lot of forensic work. And that really does need to be grounded in research. So whenever you're sort of doing that, you know, whether it be assessment for the courts or testifying or whatever, that really does need to be grounded in the research. So I think it sort of probably makes me better prepared to do that kind of work than if I wasn't doing sort of both things.
Yeah, and I imagine maybe there's a space too of, especially because your work is so rooted in that kind of clinical experience and understanding of victimization and, you know, health utilization, like you're talking about, those are very people-centered experiences, right? And so also hopefully being able to see some of the things that are coming up for clients that then inform part of the research that you're doing as well, this kind right. of bi-directional relationship.
Yeah. And the clinical work, I mean, I think to some degree does provide, I don't know how much it sparks ideas, but it certainly helps inform how we might do some things. So when we think about sort of, you know, recruiting participants, making sure they're, you know, sort of comfortable and kind of how we engage them in that data collection process, that's, I think, where sometimes the clinical work is really more informative, is what are things that work well in a clinical practice that you can translate over and use? Again, you're trying to have people be willing to share stuff that's usually pretty sensitive and pretty uncomfortable. How do you do that in a way that's going to be comfortable for them or as comfortable for them as possible and result in data that you can trust a little better. And so I think a lot of my clinical practice helps inform that particular process of doing this in a way that feels, you know, okay with for participants.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so you mentioned a couple of projects, one that just wrapped up, one that you're getting started with. Can you talk a little bit about those? I know you also have NIJ funding for at least one of those, I think. So if you could talk about that a bit.
So they're actually both NIJ funded.
Okay.
Most of the funding is by NIJ. So the one we're wrapping up is a longitudinal study looking at victimization of Latinos, particularly Latino adults, particularly looking at and bias and hate crime experiences. And while we looked at a lot of other aspects of victimization, that was sort of the focus of that project. And so that one is the one that just wrapped up. So we're sort of, you know, doing sort of the data analysis, starting to do a lot of the writing for that. So that project, probably the highlight of that project, which will be not surprising and mildly depressing, is that, you know, we looked at bias and hate crime experiences among these groups. You know, they've really sort of skyrocketed over the past year, depressingly. although in some ways, probably not surprisingly, given I think some of the sociopolitical environment we're in right now. And I think the thing that is sort of most striking is a couple of things. First of all, the bulk of it is from these bias victimization experiences that wouldn't necessarily qualify as hate crime. Name calling, you know, possible like, you know, work, discrimination, things like that, are really sort of what drive the experiences they're having. Now, the most experience of hate crime, and that also sort of went up, but it's really the bias stuff that's sort of driving that victimization experience. And it's really sort of, honestly, to me, a little surprising sort of how much of it we saw from 1 year to the next. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty huge increase. I think it was something like 60%.
Wow.
From 1 year to the next. The other thing that I think was really sort of that this project, I think, brings to mind is that, you know, to some degree, we depend a lot on either official statistics about hate crime or sort of these national level surveys and self-report surveys. And one of the issues, I think, is some of the folks who are particularly vulnerable for this kind of experience are probably the folks who are going to get missed in both of those. And so one of the other things is that we are seeing just massive underreporting of this. Mm. Even if we just look at the hate crime, not so the things that we get reported, like in the to the FBI, we're looking at something like it's like 1/9,000 of each incident is being actually officially reported in official statistics. And so it's really sort of something that is happening a lot, and it's, you know, it's just what we see in some of those, and even for self-report, it's a huge underreporting. So we're really just sort of seeing the tip of the iceberg when it comes to that. And from our data, it's a pretty big iceberg.
Yeah. Knowing that it also comes from this kind of justice lens or justice system lens too, what are you and your team walking away from in terms of responses to say, you know, we need to do this part better, or and maybe even preliminarily, because I know you're still sort of looking at it and probably having those conversations, but just thinking about the criminal justice system in that way, where are you seeing the need and what might fill in that gap, I guess? Because what you're talking about, right, is such underreporting in ways that we aren't really talking about. And it also almost makes me think about when we consider stalking. We've had similar conversations around there's so much that leads up to even something being considered stalking and categorized that way. And kind of when you're talking about these things that lead to a bias or to a hate crime, there's so much prior to that that isn't classified. And that seems like a huge element to what we need to think about in terms of criminal justice response in that way.
And I think one of the problems is that sort of, I think, interfering with the criminal justice response is right now these communities, and again, I'm focusing on the chief community because that's who our project was focused on, really don't trust the criminal justice system in a lot of ways, for a lot of reasons and a lot of legitimate reasons. And I think the other thing that's interesting is that it is not a immigrant problem. We did qualitative interviews as well to sort of supplement the quantitative data that we had. And one of the things we're seeing is that it didn't matter what your status was. The community as a whole was experiencing this, and the community as a whole was sort of feeling like they couldn't trust the system. And so you get a lot of reluctance to report because you're worried you're going to get, you know, reported to immigration, regardless of what your immigration status is. And I think it's sort of, to some degree, telling that this is really impacting the community as a whole, and it's not just an issue of, it's just an immigrant issue, an undocumented immigrant issue. It's not. It's the whole community. The concern is there, and the lack of trust and the sort of unwillingness to sort of, you know, report is there. I was telling this example to somebody because I was having this conversation with somebody, and someone said, well, you know, to me as a Latino, I said, well, you probably don't really have to worry about that. I said, here's the thing. I had to go for work to Phoenix last year. I put my passport card in my wallet and I took it with me. I wasn't leaving the country. I wasn't going anywhere outside the country. I was going to Arizona. And to me, it was enough of a concern that I was going to Arizona that I actually put my passport card in my wallet and I haven't taken it out.
Wow.
Now, I'm a reasonable guy. I'm not overly paranoid, but I looks at this from a different lens to some degree, still recognize that the way things have been recently and the way some of these criminal justice agencies have been functioning, nobody gets a pass. So does it matter, you know, what I look like or where I hang out or whatever? I still feel like, you know what, I need to have a little backup just in case. And that my passport card's still in my wallet.
Mm.
Probably will be for a while.
Mm, yeah. Well, I appreciate you telling that story. And I feel like the what you highlight is so critical, because the popular narrative of that it is an immigrant issue, or that we want to kind of place that on that group, that this is a and sort of further marginalize and further isolate, to say that this is why we're seeing these things. It's not surprising, but feels pretty critical to have data that shows that that isn't the case. And the anecdotes like your story.
It's the simple rule in some ways of, you know, perpetrators are going to look at you and make assumptions and say, and then, you know, call you names or assault you or whatever the case may be. Nobody's going to go, hey, are you a documented immigrant? Are you a U.S. citizen? Because I want to know that before I call you, you know,
right,
slur. No, nobody's asking. So I think that's part of the issue, is those who perpetrate this don't care and don't sort of want to know anything about that. And so that's why it's the community. Because it's not just immigrants being targeted. It's not just undocumented folk being targeted. It's anybody who fits the image that somebody has of that, if that's what they're going to do in terms of, you know, act out or you know, the name calling on the other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then it feels like the popular narrative wants to specify because it's easier to dismiss.
Right.
Well, I'm very excited. I mean, I'm not excited of your outcomes, but it sounds like right. A really amazing stepping stone to that point of really trying to provide some contextualization to the reality of what these experiences are like, and to kind of what you raised, it's incredibly timely. Unfortunately, but that there's not a more important moment for us to be looking at some of the hard information that has been here all along, but is definitely seeing some serious spikes in the recent years. So, and then thinking about the project that you're working toward, like what has been sort of that connection or that pathway, and sort of what comes next with the work that you're looking at?
So that part of it is that it's not so much that one is sort of kind of leading to the other one, but it is one. It's sort of, you know, we have, I'm co-director of the Violence Justice Research Lab that sits within the Institute of Race and Justice in the School of Criminology. And so we have sort of a lot of sort of different sort of projects in the same sort of umbrella arena, if you will. And so in the lab, we've had a lot of trafficking work in the past. Professor Amy Farrell, my colleague there, and the other PI on this project, has really done a lot of that work. And so this kind of was a combination of, you know, the work she's been doing in trafficking and the fact that I sit in the sort of mental health world and have done some sort of health research, you know, sort of way back. And so this project came about because of a call focused on health and trafficking. And so the project starts at the beginning of the year. It's a sort of pretty collaborative. We've got colleagues from Apt Associates and University of New Hampshire and Boston University on the School of Public Health. And we are looking at domestic violence, sexually exploited trafficking victims, and querying about both physical and mental health outcomes, as well as their health service utilization. And so the project sort of has that sort of quantitative component. And then we're also doing qualitative interviews with adult trafficking survivors to sort of kind of get some context and talk to them sort of retrospectively about, hey, did you ever get healthcare when you were, you know, trafficking victim? You know, what health is, all these sort of things, asking about the sort of healthcare experience and looking to see if how they were impacted and what, to what degree they were experiencing sort of health consequences and had access to health services. And so that project starts in January. It's a 3-year project and it's involves a lot of colleagues and collaborators, and should be interesting to see how we do it in sort of this pandemic environment, because when we wrote it, we hadn't, you know, this hadn't really hit yet. But we wrote it in a way that I think we've got a lot of ways to do this creatively that we'll still be able to recruit, we'll still be able to get the data, and be able to, you know, get participants into our study, even though we may have to be a little creative about how we get them.
I'm taking notes because there's just like a lot of different things that come up when you're talking. But one of them is to speak a bit to the collaboration. Like, what do you see as being important to having funding that allows for that sort of breadth of collaboration, that like overlap? And what, if anything, are you kind of hopeful for in this project, in this next phase of the work you're looking at?
So I think one of it, and this is sort of, so everybody who's in this group that is on this project are folks we've worked with before. So it's Lisa Jones and Kimberly Mitchell from UNH, from the CCRC, Crimes Against Children Research Center, Emily Rothman from BU. So a lot of folks we've collaborated with before. So this isn't new. The nice thing about it is that, and I think sort of the benefit of this, is that it's a very interdisciplinary group. On our team from Northeastern, we also have Lisa Lincoln, who's had a lot of health research in the past. And so it's folks who complement each other really well. But it's also, you know, sort of relationships we've had with a lot of these folks already. I mean, we've had projects with everybody who's on this before. But it is that interdisciplinary nature that I think is the big sell for getting funding like this, but also the kind of team you need for a project like this. And so I think that's one of the things that we're really excited about, is that we're working with just a really sort of strong group of people who are going to have very different perspectives on everything. You know, we've got psychologists, sociologists, you know, public policy in that mix, in terms of sort of everybody's sort of degrees, if you will, whatever says on the diploma. I think the other thing that's really nice, and this is actually sort of a common thread in our research generally, is that there's a lot of sort of community agency researcher collaboration. So every project we've had, the bias organization project that I just talked about, this forthcoming project, other projects we've done in the lab, all have a lot of connection to agencies that are sort of doing direct service work. And so, and again, a psychologist that sort of kind of is sort of one of the links for me, if you will. And so one of the things we are sort of excited about is that we're also going to be doing this recruitment in collaboration with agencies that serve this population. So a number of sort of, you know, trafficking service agencies that are in various parts of the country. So California, Chicago, here, Boston area, New Hampshire. So it's sort of a nice mix of researcher practitioner partnerships, as well as sort of a really complementary research team. The downside of all that is that's a lot of people and a lot of agencies to manage in one project, but we've done that before, but probably not to the degree that we're doing it with this project, because that's a lot of cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for explaining that. So one of the things that you talked about too is, you know, being one of the directors of the Violence and Criminal Justice Lab, right? I believe that's the right name. So can you just talk a little bit about the sort of what that is and what you do there at the lab, sort of what the hope is with that kind of collaborative type of center?
Sure. So the Institute of Race and Justice, which is an institute in the School of Criminology, within the institute is the Violence and Justice Research Lab, which is our lab. And it's interesting because this is one of those things where sort of it's nice that we're sort of a very interdisciplinary group at Northeastern, because the lab model isn't something you usually see in criminology. If I were working in a psychology department, you know, everybody gets a lab. That's not a model that you have in criminology or sociology, sort of by design. And so in our unit, it was sort of novel to do that, to bring that sort of to the institute. And so what the lab really is, it's essentially sort of the research and mentoring arm of the Institute of Race and Justice. So Professor Farrell and I are sort of the ones who sort of head it up, and a lot of it is funding that we get from, you know, our various grants that we have or that we've had. And that's sort of the research part. A lot of it is NIJ funding. We sort of are seeing that, you know, sort of have other smaller funding pockets. We have funding sort of from local state government and things like that. So it sort of tends to be a relatively diverse sort of funding portfolio. But then the other aspect of it is it has a very structured mentoring component to it. And it's not only just sort of the doctoral students who are there. And again, this is the idea, like if somebody goes to work at somebody's lab, this is kind of how it works in psych and other sort of lab-based disciplines. And so what you have is you have the doctoral students that work with us, but then we also have master's and undergraduate students in the lab. And so one of the things we sort of, that's sort of the things we like about what we do there is that the mentoring is structured. So to some degree, everybody gets it. And sometimes it's, you know, we have a writing seminar for people to sort of, you know, have their work reviewed before it goes out for publication. We've got trainings on different research, you know, techniques or software or whatever it is. And because we have doctoral and master's and undergraduate students, part of the mentoring is the doctoral students mentoring the master's and undergraduate students. So we call this sort of intergenerational mentoring sort of process. And so the nice thing about it is our doctoral students get experience mentoring other people, which is usually not an experience you necessarily get in graduate school, but it's a thing you eventually are going to have to do, particularly if you're going into any kind of a research or academia kind of position. And so there's sort of this aspect of it, which has training on mentoring, training on grant writing, because everybody who's working with us also kind of helps with the grant writing process. And so it gives us an opportunity to, in some ways, very efficiently provide this mentoring that, in a lot of cases, isn't mentoring you got when you're in your doctoral program. So, for example, I didn't get any mentoring around sort of grant writing when I was in my grad school. I didn't get that until I was at my postdoc. And so the fact that our students get that, the fact that our students get opportunities to learn how to mentor and manage a project are sort of things that aren't sort of the big ticket items in some ways when you're sort of going out to the market, the work market, but it is one of those things that you can point to and go, yeah, I've had experience doing that. And it's not a typical thing the average grad student coming out of their doctoral program will have had. So that structure makes us able to sort of put us in a position where we can sort of do more things with more people. So that's sort of the two key pieces of the lab is the research component, the research funding and the research, you know, the grant writing part and the mentoring part.
Yeah, that is such a big element. And I think too, kind of where you talked about not having gotten it until a postdoc, like being able to apply and particularly participate in federal calls, like from places like NIJ. It's a very specific process and a very specific journey. And having that kind of guidance early on and some exposure to what that is like is pretty much is kind of a game changer in terms of being able to then enter into the field later as an early career researcher and feel confident in your ability to go after some of that funding. And I think it's great because for the most part, what we would want as researchers is sort of a spectrum of career trajectories and career placements in that we want to have funding that supports opportunities where you have earlier career folks and then later career folks that are, you know, intersecting and not just living in the silos of one of those sort of pathways or timelines. So yeah, that's pretty great. Really kind of my wrap up and one of the big goals, as I had mentioned, about doing these conversations is to hear from you as an expert in the field and an expert in your area. What do you see as gaps in the work and what would you like to see as sort of next steps in seeing funding, seeing calls for research specifically around like criminal justice and sort of that understanding victimization and specifically for you, like in your area, of understanding what that's like for the Latino community and
So, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. I think one thing that's really interesting is, and this may not be the most sort of the most direct answer to this part of your question, but I think there's this issue of, I think it's a whole sort of measurement issue when it comes to the field in general. So one of the projects we have is developing a new measure of adolescent dating violence for, you know, with youth. And I think, you know, what we developed and tended to overcome a lot of things around sort of the diversity of sort of who these sort of instruments are developed with, trying to overcome some limitations of the previous instruments. So I think there's one piece that's this measurement piece that has to do with recognizing that things what we may have used in the past don't necessarily retrofit or perfectly fit everybody. And so there needs to be adaptation and all that. And the reality that times change and sort of what we ask about should also change. If you think, you know, about dating violence and sort of take a measure like the conflict tactic scale sort of retrofitted to youth, okay, that can work. But, you know, it doesn't have any questions about all the sort of online digital ways that, you know, that a lot of that behavior happens. And so we can't say we have a good instrument that works and assume that that will be the case, you know, sort of for everybody and going forward. We have to sort of be open to recognizing that those things will have to change because the nature of the problem we're studying changes. The same thing goes around things like asking about bias victimization. A lot of surveys don't include those questions, not until more recently. And one of the things we found out is that we were getting really high rates off of our bias victimization instrument to this level that was essentially the same level as our other victimization instrument that we're using in that survey, which made us realize when we used that instrument in the past, it didn't have these separate bias questions. Those questions were probably sort of getting kind of, you know, swallowed up by the other violence questions. So we didn't really know sort of separately, is it bias or is it something else? You report a physical assault, but we didn't know if that was a bias event or if it was a, you know, some other kind. You just said who did it, what happened, but there was no context there for that. Same thing with the project we had with our colleagues at UNH. They developed the bias victimization instrument for youth. And so I think there's a whole measurement piece that is, we need to be sort of, I think, more open to the idea that as researchers, we can't just sort of find our instrument that we like and that works and kind of just clamp down and keep using it. We have to recognize that sometimes that may not work or stop working or won't work for who we're trying to reach. So I think that's one issue. I think the other thing that is more to your question around sort of where do I see things going in the sort of the violence field generally. I think we, in a lot of ways, make assumptions about the homogeneity of certain groups. And we need to be better at not doing that, measuring the things that make those communities diverse, and three, sort of capturing the folks that we often tend to not capture. So if you think about, you know, any sort of underserved, understudied group, they also tend to be the folks that are hard to sort of to research. And so, you know, our work has been a lot with Latinos, and one of the things we have to do is we have to ask about immigration status and acculturation and whether they immigrated or not, because those are things that are part of the diversity of that community. And some of those subgroups, like, you know, migrant workers or folks who live more in sort of, you know, ethnic enclaves, things like that, those folks aren't the ones that are going to show up on big national service. So if you have questions about how that community is impacted, you kind of have to go there and connect with them and sort of really recruit them directly. Same thing happens when you look at LGBTQ community. If you're interested in looking at violence experiences in the transgender community, which is, you know, very disproportionately high, you can't just do a national survey. You have to go to that community and recruit them. And you have to do it in a way that they realize that you sort of know, you kind of know what you're doing. So you need to have a little bit of sort of kind of legitimacy, if you will, that you aren't just a researcher who just happened to pick a new group of people, but that you actually sort of can engage and connect with that community and have them help inform you in how to do this. How we ask about things like sexual orientation, gender, things like that, is going to look very different when you're targeting the LGBTQ community than it necessarily would in a big national survey where those folks are going to be hard to find. So I think that's the other piece, is sort of how do you reach those groups that tend to be the ones that don't show up in a lot of research? And so they tend to be the ones that we know less about when it comes to sort of their needs and their experiences with violence and kind of what we can do from an intervention and prevention standpoint. And then the last thing I'll mention is this issue of intersectionality, which is this idea that, you know, you're not just Latino, you're not just LGBTQ, but you may be a Latino woman who is racially Black. I mean, it's just, and any one of those pieces that are part of your identity isn't necessarily going to be where you sort of centrally sort of see yourself, versus sort of where we as researchers and outsiders might think, oh, this is the sort of the demographic we're targeting. I think we need to get better at how we capture that. Because I think historically we've been sort of like, we're going to ask about this, and we're going to ask about this, and we're going to ask about this. And we don't look at, well, the combination of those different parts of the person is going to be really different based on A, what the combinations are, and B, sort of how they centrally see themselves, what community they tend to sort of, you know, feel they belong more to, what sort of, you know, kind of where they're, who they're part of. And I think this idea of doing a better job of capturing the sort of diverse nature of communities and the intersectionality of individuals is something that I think in research we're going to have to learn to do better, because we haven't really done it very well. And I think it will sometimes mean that we're going to miss certain things. So I think moving in that direction and sort of talking to those sort of the folks in those communities to get a better understanding how to do that better is a big important thing that I think we need to do going forward.
Yeah. For me, that's such a wall that I guess I come up against really frequently. And intersectionality is a huge part of my dissertation work, and I'm doing qualitative data collection, particularly for that reason. I mean, one, because I think that qualitative kind of builds it in my perspective, that I think that's a really great starting place to then build from there, is to kind of have those conversations, learn from the communities, and then how do we address quantitative data collection? But I think what I come up against too, and why doing qualitative interviews was right for my particular interest, was because intersectionality is so important to me and my lens, and that I'm not sure the wall that I'm coming up against is, I struggle to figure out how quantitative research can respond to that. And I think that is just a limitation of my training and my just maybe my lack of experience. But I think that what you spark for me is that question of like, do you have a vision? Do you have ideas? Do you have thoughts on like how we do? Because to your point, the way that we've been trained in terms of quantitative data collection is very like, we're looking at this, and even when we measure. And so I guess I come to a theoretical question of like, is it even possible to collect numbers and analyze data in a way that gets at intersectionality? And what could that look like? Or do we need to re-envision methodology and data even beyond that? And I kind of would say it's a both answer, but like, I'm curious to hear your thoughts, since it's clear you're tossing this around too. So
the funny thing is that I'm a numbers guy. I'm a quant guy. And which is a little bit ironic because I'm also a clinician. So I sort of, you know, essentially, you know, being a clinician is doing, you know, 50-minute qualitative interviews with a purpose. It's essentially, You could sort of reframe what a therapy hour is that.
Yeah.
But I think the thing, and this is after also Professor Farrell, who's the colleague I work with a lot, and she does a lot of qualitative work. I think it's the idea of figuring out how to use these things complementary, in a complementary way. Every project we've had most recently, the Biden's grant, the forthcoming trafficking project, both have a qualitative component to them. And one of the things we've been seeing, particularly now that we're trying to look at the data for the hate crime project, is that that qualitative data is complementary to the quantitative data we have. We do our analysis, we see what we get in our quantitative results, but we have this whole pool of qualitative data that helps us inform the conclusions and the context that lets us make sense of those numbers. And so one of the things that's been incredibly useful is using the qualitative data that's being analyzed separately as a resource for understanding some of the things we're seeing in the numbers. And the nice thing about sort of mixed methods projects like this is when we talk about our results in the discussion, we can actually cite or sort of refer to the qualitative information to say, and hey, you know, given our qualitative piece that we did here, that helps us understand that this, you know, relationship we're seeing here may be in part a result of, you know, this, that, and the other.
Right, right.
And so for me, it, you know, sort of my evolution as a researcher and that, you know, hardcore numbers guy, if you will, is that a lot of the qualitative work, while some of it, you know, sort of stands on its own, is really particularly useful when you are using it with quantitative research, because that's part of what helps you make sense of what you're seeing numerically, and in some ways helps you maybe find ways to measure things a little better or measure them in a way that is going to capture some of what you think might be missing. And so I think some of this mixed methods approach to a lot of research, particularly violence research, and particularly with these communities, I think it's sort of, you know, from a where, what should we be doing as researchers is one of the really important things, because it, I think, helps fill in whatever gaps each methodology might have.
So last question, if someone were to just give you unrestricted $1 million to do some form of research, what would you do?
So I think there's a couple of things. I think for me, if I had, you know, big, you know, pile of money, I think the next sort of kind of general project idea in this arena would really be to try and tackle this question of sort of that the some way tackle this question of intersectionality and violence. It's, I think, both at the individual level and in sort of the more sort of system level or sort of environmental macro level, it really is important to say, okay, if I'm focused on the LGBTQ community and I'm talking to a Latino youth, his experience is going to be very different than if I'm talking to a white older man. The thing they have in common is they identify as part of that of the LGBTQ community. But what that experience is going to be in terms of risk of violence, what their experience is going to be in terms of access to services, what their experience is going to be in terms of, their sort of risk exposure is going to be very different. They both may fall in this community that they have in common, but a Latino 18-year-old and a, you know, 43-year-old, you know, white male aren't going to have the same experience in terms of risk and prevention and resources and all that. And so I think for me, questions that tackle intersectionality, maybe within certain communities or certainly in sort of in some sort of structured way, I think is part of where I would want to go. Somebody said, here's a boatload of money, go do what you want to do for research. And part of the reason why the research requires a boatload of money is because it's hard to do. You can't do just a big internet survey and get to those questions. You have to go to those communities. You have to go do that recruitment in person. You have to have those partnerships with those communities, community agencies. And that's work that is more laborious, takes more time, and isn't cheap.
Absolutely.
Don't get me wrong. I do long for the days where we could give a bunch of money to a survey firm and get reliable data.
Absolutely.
Both survey in 3 months. our first project we had over a decade ago, data collection got done in 3 months by a survey firm.
But
all these questions I have now and all these sort of things I'm running into looking at, that, well, A, calling people just not going to be a thing that we can trust anymore, period. Ask any pollster for the last two elections.
Right.
Two, that's not how you get those folks.
Right.
There's no way we would have recruited the Latino sample that we have for our bias project if for the first wave of data collection, we hadn't gone in person to these agencies, to, you know, every Latino festival, you know, Puerto Rican festival, the Colombian festival, the Venezuela, I mean, you name it, we went to it. Nobody complained because the food was good. But if you don't show up and show up with a team that reflects the community you're targeting, so our team was diverse, more than half the team was bilingual, we're not going to get those folks. They're not going to trust us to tell us the things we're asking them because we're asking really sensitive stuff. That research has to happen with that connection. If not, you're just not going to be able to get the folks you're trying to get.
Maybe we just need to make more of that argument. Like, listen, if we do this work, you get to go to these festivals and we're going to eat good food. So, like, give us some money to do that and it's going to be great,
none of the RAs complain. Hey, you guys, last minute, there's this festival this weekend. Anybody want to complain? They're like, which one? We're like Columbia food. We're going. Nobody
complain. I think that's just a missed selling point. We're overlooking this. So,
It'll certainly show up as a perk next time I put out an ad for hiring for a research assistant.
Come join us.
This is the project for you.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I really appreciated learning more about your work and good luck as you move forward in your project, continuing in a pandemic. So, you know.
Well, knock on wood.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. You can always find more of these coffee chats on our website, which is vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And of course, you can always reach out to us via social media or via email. We are always happy to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions, your feedback, or just generally to give us a hello. As always, stay curious, ask questions, drink coffee, and we will see you for our next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. Yes.